Welcome to the Bulwark Daily. I'm your host, Tim Miller. It is Monday, so we are back with Bill Kristol. We're in the doldrums of August, and you know, there's still terrible news out there, though, in the doldrums of August. How are you doing, Bill?
Yeah, I'm doing fine, but I agree that the news is not universally great.
We're going to run through some of the stuff. I'm going to start here because it seems like me and Bill are the only ones who are upset about this, so I'm going to put it at the top of the podcast. The U.S. Senate on Friday did pass a government funding bill that will prevent a shutdown to the midterm elections. The CR passed 90-6. So only five Democrats voted against it. Actually, Rand Paul always votes against this sort of stuff. The senators, according to reports from the Hill types, Notice and Punch Bowl, senators seem to be gearing up for a bigger fight in December. I don't know. Hard to say. I saw a silver lining. Bill saw a silver lining. One silver lining I saw is that the CR does push back the ban on weed beverages, which I can't believe that they're going through with. It's just a disaster for small business people all over the country, including in red states and districts. But we're going to need our weed beverages to get through the midterm. So any delay on that, I guess, would be good. Besides that, I'm mystified why all the Democrats went along with this. I guess I should say, before we get to Bill, it's not over yet, or I wouldn't have led the show with it. The CR they passed in the Senate is different than the one in the House. Now the House has to vote on it again. So conceivably, this, you know, if Hakeem Jeffries and the Democrats in the House decided that they wanted to pick a fight over something, that is still possible. I encourage them to do so. Bill, what's your thoughts on the state of play over there on the Hill?
You know, you and I have this in common that we take a position, it loses 90-6 in the United States Senate, and we're still thinking, hey, we're right, you know? What are those 44, whatever they are, 41, I guess, Democratic senators know that we don't know? I mean, look, it's a CR, so there's some argument always for keeping the government open and not getting into a frantic September bargaining where which parts of it are going to be open and stuff. But they are funding a lot of bad stuff. They're funding the ongoing operations of ICE, the ongoing operations of the war, the ongoing operations of this and that. I at least would have made Republicans withdrawing the reconciliation bill a condition of the vote. Maybe they did that tacitly because the Republicans did withdraw or have not moved on the reconciliation bill, which has the $60+ billion for defense and various other appropriations, most of which are probably bad. So that is a bit of a silver lining, and which means there still will be fights in September, as you say, partly in the House as they move to accept the Senate bill, or if they don't accept it, then they have to go to a conference committee. Wasn't that a thing that used to happen? Kind of remember that for major pieces of legislation. That seems not to happen anymore. But anyway, so it still is alive in that respect. And then, as I say, there still will be fights on reconciliation and on other issues as well. So,
well, these guys don't work, really. And so the House is not back until September.
Right. I think very end of August, and I think the Senate is September 14th right now. It's like unbelievable.
So this could be one of these situations. I mean, we're being a little glib about it, but as I recall, the last shutdown fight, or maybe it was two shutdown fights ago, was the events of Minnesota that like caused it, right? Like the Democrats were on path to kind of doing this, you know, continuing kicking the can thing. And then there's this righteous outrage for good reason over the behavior of ICE that then gave a kick in the pants to the Democrats, you know, who are like, okay, well, we can't fund this government right now. And that kind of led to the last fight. Long time till September, I guess. Now, who the hell knows what's going to happen, what horrors the Trump administration will inflict upon us between now and then. But I do think that anything that kind of extends that timeline creates a possibility that there's another galvanizing kind of event to organize around. And I agree that just like the facts of this is that this is kind of continuing of the status quo through December versus a reconciliation bill would have given them more money for the stupid war and for the stupid war at home and deportations. But to me, even still, the status quo is like a no. Yeah. The status quo is a no. I don't see, just steelmaning the argument of the Democrats, I guess it would say, we don't want to give them anything going ahead to the midterms. We feel good about the midterms. We don't want to give them the opportunity of saying that we're shutting down the government and that is harming people. But I just don't see how that would be an effective argument for the Republicans.
I think that is their private political argument. We're winning. Let's not rock the boat too much. I always get worried. This is like teams going into prevent defense much too early, you know, I feel like. But psychologically, it's a bad sign that they, in a sense, went along with this. The Democrats won the previous two fights politically, right? Yes. The first was at the end of September, right? It was September, October, the government shut down, which coincided with Trump dropping some more in the polls and extremely good election results last November in Virginia and New Jersey. And then the second fight, as you say, was after Minneapolis on DHS. Ultimately, they got that funding back through their earlier reconciliation bill. But that fight did really help, I think. It brought home that there was a split between the two parties on this fundamental question of mass deportation.
And substantively, they had to use the reconciliation to fund it. Right. You know what I mean? So, like, again, that could have been something else that the Republicans had done to pass. And they, the Democrats successfully got that funding out of, you know, the broader budget. Republicans had to use reconciliation. So again, this is like a minor win in the grand scheme of things, but the Democrats are in the minority. And so minor wins are what you're going for.
Right. They had two wins in a row, and God forbid they should pursue the same strategy the third time. That's kind of too complicated for the Democrats. So they've talked themselves into, I think, an excessively passive strategy, but not the end of the world. And
no, not the end of the world. But I'll note that, again, it's like, it's our people. This is really why I feel like it's incumbent upon us to do it, because it's like, who are the no votes? Warren, Sanders, Tim Kaine. Shout out to Tim Kaine was the one guy that I saw in the bill from more of the mainstream party that was.
I think on the war probably was what moved him. He's been very outspoken on the war powers stuff. And he's right to be, incidentally. And they couldn't demand a vote from Republicans. I guess they don't need to demand a vote. I guess those resolutions are privileged. They get votes anyway. That's why there have been so many of them. But they really need to be ready to fight on the war and on ICE and on everything else in those 2 weeks that they're back in September.
Some of this is just messaging and positioning. And like, this is just my view on the war thing overall. This isn't 2003. You don't need to do the thing where like, oh, we're worried that if we fight over war funding, the people are going to be mad at us because we're not funding the troops. It's like, nobody wants this. The president doesn't even want the stupid war. Like, nobody wants a stupid war. Plant your flag in the ground, you know, and make an argument on the funding side of this that you're not going to provide another penny for this thing. For this thing that nobody wants, it's hurting people in America, that's hurting our standing abroad, and that's achieving no results. So we're going to get back to the war. Sorry. There's my war rant. But let's just stay on the hill for a second. Max Miller, because you wrote about this morning for the newsletter. Today is like ostensibly the deadline for Max Miller, the very credibly alleged domestic abuser that the Republicans are running in an Ohio House seat, for him to get off the ballot and be replaced by somebody else. You pointed out to me that technically he had to write a letter by Saturday, actually. The deadline might already be passed, but ostensibly today is the final day. The Republicans, Donald Trump and Mike Johnson in particular, the NRCC, have not done anything to push him aside. They've stood beside him. They've continued to enable him. And I just think it's just another pretty stark example of just the weakness and cowardice of these guys.
Yeah, it's amazing. A few senators have spoken up, but only because their colleague, Bernie Moreno, who's the father-in-law, ex-father-in-law of Miller, the father, obviously, of Emily Moreno, who was married to Miller and abused by her, she says, quite credibly, only because they were sort of supporting their colleague. If the victim here had been someone whose father was not a senator, I don't know that any senators would have spoken up. But more to the point, the House members, who are actually Miller's colleagues, have been incredibly silent, led by their leaders, if you can call them that. Speaker Johnson, who's busy giving interviews about how, you know, life is complicated. What did he say? We're all flawed human beings, something like that. I mean, it's really a little philosophy there from the speaker. You know, we said, God forbid we should actually do anything about someone who's been charged for this and speak out against him, really urge him to resign from the House or at least not run for re-election, say you wouldn't, the NRCC shouldn't provide funding for him, et cetera, et cetera. But no, they're so passive. And once Trump and Johnson are okay with it, they seem to be fine with it. It's amazing. The excuses they find for not taking a position on something.
His opponent in that House race, Brian Poindexter, I don't want to pretend like I know a ton about him, but I do want to read to you the lead of the New York Times story about him from over the weekend. Brian Poindexter, until recently a little-known Democratic candidate in a solidly Republican House district, lit a Marlboro cigarette and jammed a screwdriver into the latch of a shed door he had built. He ignored his phone, which had been blowing up because of the Miller scandal. Quote, "It's crazy to have him running for Congress," said Poindexter's father, Bob, who had made bolts for a living until he retired last year. He was watching his son work. What would be really crazy if he won? You know, Democrats looking for guys that are smoking cigarettes and fixing shed doors. So that's a good start. And we've been flagging this from before. You know, the Times flagged this as a solidly Republican House district. It was always in that kind of batch of House districts that I've been really focused on that we included in our list, which we'll put again here in the show notes. People missed it a couple weeks ago. These kind of R plus 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 seats that, sure, in a good Republican year are solid R. But it was, you know, kind of in that next edge of vulnerable seats, even before this scandal.
Yeah, and I think Miller in 2024, well, Trump won it by fairly comfortably, but I think Miller got like 51.something% of the vote. There was some independent candidates, so his margin's a little bigger, you know, is more than 3 points or something. But yeah, so he's never been super popular, nor should he be, you know, unqualified Trump staffer who was vaguely involved in helping to organize, was involved, not just vaguely, in helping to organize the January 6th. The speech by Trump, I guess he was some kind, maybe he was an advanced guy or something, I don't know, helping arranging the speakers at that just terrible rally, which incited the storming of the Capitol. So he was involved in that. Then he wins in 2022 because Trump endorses him. He's the son of a very, or son, grandson, nephew, whatever, very rich family in Cleveland, the Miller family, but has never been, so far as one can tell, particularly popular in the district. So I do think that's a winnable race. And I think all the Ohio races are winnable. I think this will spill over to the senatorial race, the gubernatorial race. It looks like the Democrats are at least even in both of those. Maybe Ohio will go back to being what it was in our youth, Tim, you know, when it was an actual swing state, the closest state in 2004.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because that's where I was going to go next, too, because I feel like I've given Ohio a little bit of short shrift compared to some of the other big Senate races, in part just because it's a little more, you know, there's a kind of status quo with Sherrod Brown against John Husted. Husted did not handle this scandal with any sort of honor or integrity. And he spent days avoiding saying anything and then kind of put out the most tepid imaginable statement about Miller. And then over in the governor's race, you have Amy Acton running against Vivek, my old pal Vivek, who I followed around Iowa. Vivek, I didn't realize this till yesterday because I was kind of getting ready for the pod. Like, Vivek's already spent like $40 million on that governor's race, and Acton spent basically nothing, at least on the airwaves, and it's tied. So, and he's spending a ton of money just to barely stay above water. The data center issue, massive in Ohio, one of the biggest states in the country for the amount of data centers being built. And like, they gave this insane tax break to the companies that's causing a budget hole. And Vivek was out there cheerleading all that. So between the data centers and Max Miller, and obviously all of the economic wreckage Trump is bringing, all of those feel winnable for the Democrats for the first time in a minute.
Yeah, I agree very much so. And it would be nice to have Ohio back as a real swing state. It'd be nice to have Ohio with Democratic governor and senator and a couple of extra members of Congress, perhaps.
The other Republican politics thing that's just bubbling around, I just wanted to mention, your old friend Tucker, you hired Tucker, right? You hired Tucker? You're to blame.
I did. Okay. 1995. He was 24 years old, I think, yeah. 23, a good, and did work for the Weekly Standard for 5 years and was a good reporter.
I think in 1995, I was sneaking liquor out of my parents' cabinet at too young of an age. So we all made some mistakes in 1995. There was, I guess, a meeting of the minds, if you want to call it that, between Joe Kent, Marjorie Taylor Greene, Tucker, Thomas Massey, talking about potentially creating a third party, like an America First party, talking about 2028. Coming out of that, you know, there's obviously like Will Tucker run is kind of the top line thing that people discuss out of that. Though I think that Tucker, the short of that, I think basically is if Trump tries to get behind Rubio, like maybe Tucker decides to get in. But I think Tucker would be pretty satisfied with Vance. But that's kind of where things stand now. But MTG is our quote. Our argument is the two-party system is a complete and total failure. I'm 100% totally, completely disgusted with both parties. A lot of adverbs. This is not nothing. I'm not sure that this is a successful party. I don't think this is the beginnings of a successful party per se, but it is a real political issue for the Republicans.
I mean, who knows where these people all end up and who knows what Trump does? And does he run again? Does he try to get Don Jr. instead of Vance or Rubio? But the odds are not nothing that there's a genuine third or fourth party on the right, right? An MTG type America First Party. Maybe it's not ultimately the Republican Party splits in half and we have a sort of 1912 type situation or something, but maybe it is Buchanan, right? What did Buchanan get? 2.5% or something in 2000? I mean, I don't think that's at all out of the question, especially if this war drags on and Trump can't end it. And, you know, things, and Trump just seems generally unpopular enough that they don't feel intimidated by Trump or by the Republican establishment. They're certainly not intimidated by the Republican establishment in any case at this point, but Trump presumably could squash this personally, maybe, or maybe not even. Who knows where he'll be a year and a half from now. It's a pretty, you know.
Yeah, sorry to bring up bad memories for some of the listeners, but Buchanan almost is a spoiler for Bush in 2000. And ends up being a spoiler for Gore because a handful of people accidentally voted for him on the butterfly ballot who meant to vote for Gore in Florida. The point of that story is you never know what kind of impact these kind of things could have, right? Like it might feel like a kind of silly gadfly thing on the side, but here, the thing that they've got going for them is they have an actual base.
Right.
And I think that a lot of times I would get phone calls, and you would, I know, for years about why can't Jeff Flake and whoever, Joe Manchin, start a third party. And it's like, there just isn't a real support base for that. Like there's some people that might support that type of third party in a situational environment, depending on what the other two parties put up. But most people who would want that, like, are either happy with the center-left Democrats or, you know, are the tiny percentage of like Nikki Haley, Wall Street Journal Republicans who still exist, right? Like this group has a real potential base to build from that could cause a lot of problems. And obviously they have huge megaphones and Trump has made it possible for them. Like this would not have been possible if Trump had not made his own bed by like getting in bed with the tech oligarchs, covering up the Epstein files and starting the stupid war with Iran. Like Trump made this insurgency within the party possible.
Yeah, I mean, part of me wants to say no one who's anti-Trump and anti-Trumpism and anti-authoritarianism should count on this. They could end up with a pretty unified authoritarian ticket and party
In 2020. I mean, Tucker's like 10-point plan was pretty fashy.
Yeah, totally fashy, yeah. But, you know, not like Vance would be that much less so. So they could, it could be the threat. It remains very great. Having said that, on a general contrarian principle that people are always, you know, kind of wrong and these kinds of things. There's been so much publicity about the Democratic Socialists and the huge fights within the Democratic Party and God knows where they, you know, it's going to be ripped apart at the seams. I kind of assume just on contrarian principles that the Democrats will end up being reasonably united in 2028 and this fall for that matter, actually. And it's the Republicans who might beneath the surface finally sort of start to come apart at the seams. There was so much hope, wishful thinking. That's one reason I'm so hesitant to even say it for 2018, 2020, 2022, 2024, even 2026. They're not really, as we saw with Max Miller, they're not coming apart at the seams. I mean, no one's denouncing him or on Epstein in the 50 out of 52 for Todd Blanche. So one shouldn't expect it, but it does feel that there's more real tension on the Republican side. I'll put it this way. Trump has held together personally a lot. Right. Yes. I mean, the personal character of his leadership, I hate to even give him credit, but it's true. It wouldn't be happening without Trump. And so ex-Trump, if Trump does step aside or is forced aside, you know, just has to step aside because he's 82 or whatever, it could begin to really fracture in a way we haven't seen since 2016, I guess. You know?
I agree with that. And what's the line? These things happen very slowly and then all at once. I think that that's something to continue to monitor. Losing weight is one thing, but looking and feeling your best this August, that's a real goal. That's why Weight Loss by Hims now offers access to FDA-approved Wegovy pill and the Wegovy pen. Wegovy is designed to help you lose weight and keep it off, so you can show up this summer feeling like yourself. With Wegovy at Hims, it's up to 20% of your body weight when combined with diet and exercise. It's interesting. You can also lose some without any exercise, I think, if you ask the vice president. It helps you regulate your appetite, eat less, and keep weight off. Plus, Wegovy is the first ever GLP-1 pill for weight loss, so there are no needles needed, which is great for me because I'm scared of needles. Really scared of needles. And, you know, I think that served me well in life, but it's nice to know that there's a pill option. Through Hims, everything happens online. You'll connect with a licensed provider who will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your medication is delivered right to your door, no insurance necessary. And it doesn't stop there. Hims makes hitting your goals seamless by offering 24/7 messaging with your care team, an in-app lifestyle and nutrition support. Ready to reach your goals? Visit hims.com/thebulwark to get a personalized, affordable plan that gets you. That's hims.com/thebulwark. hims.com/thebulwark. Weight loss by Hims is not available in all 50 states. Wegovy is a registered trademark of Novo Nordisk AS. To get started and learn more, including important safety information, Wegovy clinical study information and restrictions, visit hims.com. The Iran war is, I just think, clearly the instigator for all of this, and has made something that was like there and, but like you said, bubbling, was under the scenes. There were potential fissures that would have been exposed eventually. The war supercharged that. I was listening to one of the kind of America Firsty podcasts I listened to over the weekend, and they played this clip from Trump talking in Nevada, and we're just mocking him. And we don't play Trump's voice on here, even though John Heilman broke that rule when he was guest hosting for me with Jill Kristol. We didn't warn him. We let the guest hosts do their own thing. Okay. Everybody could be a little nicer to John. Yeah. So I'm just going to read it, the Trump quote. Get comfortable because it's long. Here's Trump, I think, off teleprompter in Nevada, because it was supposed to be a messaging event about the economy. So I don't think Iran was supposed to come up at all. And then he does this Trump thing where he does an aside. And we're doing the same thing, by the way, in the lovely Islamic Republic of Iran. We're knocking the hell out of it, knocking the hell out of them. I'd rather make a deal because I don't want to kill people. I do not want to kill people. But at some point, we're going to. We'll not want to kill people, but at some point we're going to. We're set for the biggest attack of any attack, and we've hit them very hard the last few months, but we're all set for the biggest attack since World War II, and they called me and they said, please don't do it, sir, let's talk. And then they said, we never said that. You know what? The fake news knows they did say that, but we are talking. Let's see what happens. But they respect us. They respect us. It's been 47 years, but really it's been 50, because they've been saying 47 for 3 years. It's been 50. And no other president has done what you should have done a long time ago, because Iran cannot have a nuclear weapon, can't have it. But just last week, Kamala Harris called for eliminating the Electoral College. That was Trump in Nevada on the state of play with the Iran negotiations. He also said it could open as soon as this weekend. It's Monday. It's not open. He called Axios and said, we are low-keying it. We're only semi-negotiating with them. How can you listen to that and think that this person has any at all grasp on what's happening, or any plan or any idea?
Well, it's maybe threatening the biggest attack since World War II is not a popular thing to do. Do people really want to have the biggest attack since World War II? I kind of doubt that, you know?
That's what Tim Dillon was saying, who was listening to his. He's like, this is crazy. He's like, the biggest attack since World War II. He's like talking like a crazy person. And then he's like, oh, but we said we'd do it. But then the Iranians called me, and then they said we didn't call me. And it's like, what? He's lying. He's just obviously lying and lost. Like, he's lost.
And the Strait of Hormuz is closed. If we just come back, it's funny how much the press coverage just kind of lost sight of this. They're busy covering the big back and forth. They should remind people occasionally, the Strait is not open. And for all the talk, it opened briefly, sort of opened briefly. And now we're basically just saying, yeah, we hope Oman and Iran can work out a deal, which is like 90% Iran telling Oman what they want the deal to be, needless to say, where the Strait is open at Iran's sufferance. And that seems to be fine with Trump at this point. And plus the nuclear program he's sort of talking about less. I mean, but Iran is making it hard for him to surrender, because they kind of keep wanting to rub his face in it. And therefore, he might, I suppose, try to revert to force. But
yeah, I mean, the WSJ reporting says that Trump privately told senior aides he could just walk away from Iran if they open up the Strait of Hormuz. So like, all he wants now is just back to status quo, and he could just quit. And the Times is saying that Iran said Monday that the Strait is going to remain closed until the United States agrees to their demands on a variety of things that it's going to be very hard for them to agree to. Iran took out an oil tanker in the Strait last night, so they're still firing. It's just a disastrous situation. And I guess the point of reading his gobbledygook from Nevada is that he doesn't even have a story that he can tell about it, right? Like, even like his loss to Biden, like the story that he was telling about the 2020 didn't make any sense to anybody who's in touch with reality, but it was like a coherent story for people living in his false reality. He doesn't even really have a coherent story to tell his fans right now on Iran.
You know, that's a good point, I think. And I've been struck by that just talking to some, happened to be, I don't know, various sort of functions, social occasions with people who are not that political and stuff. And yeah, it's like, what is this about the weapons? Don't they know how to use weapons so they don't run out of them? I mean, there's enough mismanagement combined with the lack of any strategy, combined with the fact that the war's unconstitutional and illegal, combined with the fact that it's just super foolish and has been executed badly, and Hegseth's a buffoon. I just feel like altogether it's adding up to more maybe than, you know, than just, oh, it's a foreign policy misadventure or, you know.
We just made some changes in the backyard, you know, making it look a little less like a two-lane frat house back there. And it's been great. But outdoor furniture is like really expensive and it's hard to figure out what's going to hold up in the weather and what's going to be actually comfortable. One of the things I went and bought on myself was a chair that looked really cool and broke in like 8 days. So if you're like me, you ever fall head over heels for something online only to see the price and realize it's way out of budget, or only to get it and realize it's not as good as it looks, that's where dupe.com comes in. It's a tool that helps you find high quality, budget-friendly versions of the expensive pieces you've been eyeing. Super easy to use. Just go to dupe.com and paste in any product URL, upload a photo, or just type in what you're looking for, and it shows you lookalikes that won't drain your savings account. And these aren't shady knockoffs. A lot of the time, they're made in the exact same factories, just sold under a different name with a much more reasonable price tag. Instead of giving you a bunch of sponsored results and ads disguised as recommendations, Dupe digs through the options and tells you what's actually good, what's overpriced, and what to avoid. Using dupe.com is insanely simple. Just go to dupe.com and paste any product URL, upload a photo, and it'll instantly show you similar items for way less. There's also an app and a browser extension if you want to make it even easier. No account needed, totally free. Start saving money with dupe.com today. You had Edelman on the Crystal Conversations over the weekend, which was pretty good. I was listening to that just because I'm trying to like wrap my heads around like what the particulars are about this story with like our munitions being depleted. And then this is something that Edelman knows well. I point people to that if they want a deeper dive. I was interested also in this story from The Atlantic saying that Lockheed and Raytheon are refusing to license Patriot missile production to Ukraine because I think the Ukrainian manufacturers are going to be more efficient. They'd be able to improve and produce them at scale and for less money. I think this is an interesting like two stories to bring together, right? Which is kind of the corporate corruption of this White House in particular. Obviously, this is something that goes, this is not unique to this White House, but just the White House is totally for sale. You know, these big DC interests can buy these guys off. And so we've gotten into a stupid war where we're getting dangerously low on material that we need, simultaneously to the fact that like the Ukrainians are doing what you would think that like a free market pro-national security Republican administration would be excited about, which is like innovating and coming up with ways to make weapon systems faster and more effective. And we're standing in the way of that too.
Yeah, and in the conversation with Eric Edelman, but also the one I did when I was pitch hitting for you actually with Margaret Donovan, served in the Defense Department in the last decade as a JAG. And then yesterday with Pri Fram, who was kicked out of the Defense Department because she had transitioned 10 years before and had an honorable and distinguished career. But that's not good in the Trump Hegseth world. You just go around finding people who literally transitioned 10 years before and have had utterly spotless records and just purge them, you know, because they're transgender people. But we talked a little more broadly also about what's going on at the Defense Department. So she was in until December, so she's in touch with lots and lots of people. And it's bad. I mean, I think the degree of just dysfunction, mismanagement, good people leaving, bad people sucking up to their political masters to get promoted. The Defense Department already needed to be reformed. It's going to be a huge task in 2029 to sort of rebuild it in a good way and reform it at the same time and get over and restore some culture, whatever the institutional problems. And you're right, the kind of interest group, Lockheed, Raytheon type problems, procurement problems. I would say, don't you think the culture of this military was pretty impressive? People respected the military in America for good reasons. You know, there's a kind of professionalism, a kind of seriousness, sobriety, sometimes a little bit bureaucratic, but that's now, I think, is at risk because of Trump and Hegseth.
I do think that it was like the Doge critique that Elon offered, right? Which is that, like, there's all this waste in the Defense Department, and, you know, and, like, it's not something that, like, despite him being awful in every way, that, like, he'd seen firsthand. He's like, I created a SpaceX, and we can get into space, and NASA can't anymore. And so, like, that's a coherent critique, right? And then they just botch it in every way possible by putting forth these, you know, buffoons, and, you know, not actually really caring about the outcomes. But, like, I do think, you know, on the Democratic side, it's like, it's funny, like, the story offers something both for, like, the abundance efficiency Democrats and, like, the Lena Khan Democrats that are like, hey, we need more competition, we should break up these big companies that are controlling, you know, defense contracting, and also we should be, you know, bringing people in that ensure that, like, taxpayer money is being used to like, all those are all, like, legit critiques of the old Defense Department that now have been totally exacerbated by these guys. Like now it's worse than ever. And then you layer on top of that, getting back to your other point, just the buffoonery, there's no feeling of competence, you know, there's no meritocracy, who's getting promoted, who's getting fired, why, like, it's, and to me, it's like, that last point is why you can't get rid of Hegseth, right? Like, Trump wants stooges in these positions. Trump doesn't care about that. I mean, Trump is embarrassed by the Ron War. He would rather win than not, but, like, he doesn't care about, like, military effectiveness for the purpose of that, right? Like, he cares about it about in service of fluffing himself up, right? And so he needs people that will continue to do that, right? And so, I don't know. To me, it seems like, maybe I'm wrong about this. Well, the future will let us know. But I feel like Hegseth feels like among the safest.
And he's doing what Trump wants in terms of the politicization of the military. And he's been pretty aggressive and not incompetent exactly in that. I mean, he's been, maybe some of the particular things haven't been good from a PR point of view, but he's got a lot of people intimidated is what I gather. And, you know, by firing the generals he fired, by promoting the ones he's promoted, by making clear that he's willing to just reach into the ranks and politicize everything, it's not ineffective. I mean, it's a terrible way of being effective, turning us into a, you know, third-rate authoritarian military, which we're not, thank God, there yet, or even maybe near there, but in that direction. So, I agree with that. Trump doesn't care about any of that. If anything, he likes what Hegseth's doing. It's just a kind of Christie Noem PR question. It's a Pam Bondi question for me at this point. Does he think he's better off with just the political side of it? But it's not so easy to find someone else. I mean, if you find someone, and also in that confirmation fight, if he waits till after November, really risks, you know, allowing Democrats win the Senate, right? Risks turning over a lot of rocks about what the heck was happening there in the Defense Department.
And you have to find somebody that you can trust to be as loyal as Hegseth, and that also presents as slightly more competent than him.
Right.
It feels like that person could exist. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. The equivalent of Blanche, yeah, or Jay Clayton, I guess. Yeah. It feels like it, but maybe not, because military is a little more complicated. I don't know. I feel like there's a lot of pent up, a lot of people have been quiet, who've left the military, been fired. I think too many of them have been too quiet, to be honest. If you get, you know, a lot of, but whatever, they have their own culture of that. And they also have incentives not to speak up in some ways. But I feel like there's a lot of little pent up stuff beneath the surface there. And maybe the firing of Hegseth would unleash some of it.
You mentioned Blanche. We didn't talk about it because Friday I was so emotionally beaten down by the events. Do you want to share any thoughts about Tom Tillis and John Cornyn and Bill Cassidy?
I mean, they're pathetic. Cassidy, the vote's pathetic enough, but what he said on TV yesterday about how, you know, for the history books, when you really have one of these major moments, and I feel honored, privileged to have been part of this major moment of pathetic capitulation to Donald Trump, having capitulated on Robert F. Kennedy Jr. 18 months before, having gotten assurances, having watched them all just violated, as he himself even has acknowledged, right? And then I'm just going to do it again with Todd Blanche, you know, and not having met with the Epstein survivors, really, really horrible. But 50 out of 52.
Like, honestly, like, he should donate his brain to science for psychological testing, because the self-delusion here is remarkable. People get confused with a lot of things. Like, hopes and expectations and are different. So some people are like, Tim, I can't believe you're surprised that Cassidy did that. I was like, I wasn't surprised. I said at the top, I'm not surprised. So, like, I when he decided to go speak, because these guys have delusion of grandeur, I was like, I feel like there's an outside chance that the decision to speak is signaling that he wants you know, to be seen in this historic moment as somebody that did do the right thing. Because, like, Blanche was getting in eventually anyway. Like, McConnell's either getting replaced or he's going to rise from the dead and be able to make the vote, right? So, like, Blanche was getting in. So I was like, to go speak might mean that he wants to, but, and so I was kind of half right. He turns out he was speaking because he thought it was a historic moment that he wanted, you know, to get attention for. It was just that he thought that his moment was to, like, totally cave to Donald Trump's corruption of the Justice Department.
And just one more point, I'm just, you were right to, I mean, neither of us was really surprised, but it wasn't crazy to think that maybe it's a different circumstance in this way. Our friend Greg Nunziata, who runs the Society for the Rule of Law, is a genuinely conservative lawyer, worked for Republicans on the Hill on judicial and confirmations and that sort of stuff. Anti-Trump, to his credit, but still quite conservative, I'd say, in his jurisprudential views and all that kind of thing, very much opposed to Blanche. And he made the point, there's a very good point. He said, look, they all voted for these horrible candidates in January and February, and we warned them that they were going to be horrible, and they were horrible, and they deserve no pass for that. On the other hand, you could at least tell yourself then, well, we don't know. Maybe they'll be better than I fear. Let's, you know, defer to the president, the new president, on his first round of appointments. Todd Blanche has been deputy attorney general and then acting attorney general. We have a record of how Todd Blanche is going to run the Justice Department under Donald Trump. It's not a speculation the way some of these other people you could have said at first was a speculation. And Greg is very, very tough on this. He says it's such a disgrace, therefore, to have confirmed this guy, having seen what he has done on the politicization of justice, on everything else he's done there, on the dishonesty, on the Epstein cover-up. And so they deserve... That 50 out of 52 are still willing to go along, it really is extraordinary.
Utter disgrace is the right word. I want to do immigration a little bit. You guys have been covering this well in Morning Shots, in part because Jim Swift is in Ohio and been able to go to Springfield. But you know, this, the removal of the Haitians is just so horrifying. Like, the situation back in Haiti is awful. Remember the Don Rowe doctrine, given that this is in our hemisphere, of anything that we should be trying to help the conditions in Haiti. And everybody made fun of Kamala Harris, that her job during the Biden administration was the root causes of immigration, which is a very challenging job. And you know, it's like, we don't have total control over what's happening in Central America, but, like, I don't know, could at least try to help the conditions in Haiti. Instead of that, we're planning on sending people back to it. I saw you posted one of these, and there's so many now, like this really saddening video of a guy in Ohio, Haitian guy, getting an ankle bracelet put on him because the government wants to monitor all the Haitians now so they can't run away. And it's very Eastern European socialist in these images and the actions of the ICE officials. So I don't know what more there is to say about it besides the fact that it's horrifying, but I don't know if you have any thoughts.
No, just that. I mean, it's one thing to, you know, send people back to a country they came from, or Mexico, let's just say, and if they're not a personal threat, you know, okay, it's maybe right. We should keep them. Maybe we shouldn't send them back. Shouldn't send them back if they've been here for 10 or 30 years, obviously, in my view. But here you are literally sending people who came here back to a place where they are, could well be killed. I mean, no question about it. And totally unnecessary. They're doing fine. They're working hard. No one in Springfield wants them to leave. No one in Miami wants them to leave. And that, didn't you, I think you retweeted or commented on this.
This guy made me so mad. I couldn't play it. I thought about playing it, actually. And then I was just like, I'm so upset. He runs a chain of kind of Creole, I guess, food trucks. Maybe there's some brick and mortar stores too. So it's like Haitian food in Miami. And the guy's like, my business is going to collapse because the people that work, you know, the Haitians that work in the kitchen and that do other jobs are all, like, going into hiding now, or some of them are self-deporting or doing other things. And he's like, and he voted for Trump. And he's like, Trump said he was going to be a businessman. What is this doing to my business? I just wanted to scream at the guy. I was like, they did a whole thing about how your people were cat and dog eaters. Like, what did you expect?
Right. Anyway. Agreed.
I covered this story on Bulwark Takes with Ike Saul over at Tangle News. And similar to your conversation with Eric, if people want a deep dive on this, I'd encourage you to go check that out on the Bulwark Takes feed. His family is from kind of the Big Bend area of Texas, and he has a house there. And so has a really personal view on what's happening. And the story where Trump now, the wall is still being built. it's hard to kind of keep all these stories, you know, in hand, right? And the wall wasn't completely built during the first term, and they didn't build it in stupid places, and, you know, ran out of time after 4 years. There's lawsuits, et cetera. And now they are putting the wall through Big Bend National Park. And, you know, everything about this is outrageous and stupid. It's like the cost of it is insane. It's 10x what the proposed cost was, you know, to $16-18 billion of our money is going to be spent on this stupid thing. There's no crossings that happen here. It's the most desolate part of the border. It's mostly a tourist area where people go because it's beautiful, the national park, and you can see the dark skies at night. If anything, they're going to make it easier to cross there because in order to build the wall, they got to build a bunch of roads to get the construction guys in there. And so now, like, the tiny number of people that did cross the border here, it, like, ended up in this kind of desolate national park, and, you know, a lot of times ended up having to just concede themselves to borders patrol. Now potentially they'll have roads to be able to get out, so it might actually, like, help the coyotes that are trying to, like, get people into the country illegally. And the most humiliating part of it, like, in addition to the fact that it's a waste of money, it's stupid, it's counterproductive, it's going to harm a national park, we're also ceding territory to Mexico as part of this project, because, you know, just the way that they have to place the wall, there's, like, land that had been American land, which I guess came from Mexico originally, that now is going to be on the opposite side of the wall. And some of this is, like, eminent domain. Like, we're taking private property from people, building a wall on their property, and then giving some of their property to Mexico. So Trump has been talking about a lot of territory expansion, but so far only territorial concessions from Trump. So that's a typical Trump story as well. Crazy.
It was a good conversation. I learned a lot from, I don't know how to think about Big Bend. I've never been there, but yeah, it seems like a beautiful place. And totally, I get it. What's most striking is you say totally 100% unnecessary. Again, in other circumstances, you can at least, there's some argument on the other side. What's there? There's no one crossing. It's insane.
Yeah. The MAGA sheriffs down there are like, we don't want this. What are you doing?
Right.
It did make me want to visit Big Bend because I actually didn't know a lot about it, but it's challenging to get to, which I guess is the point. Okay. I had some listeners that gave me some negative feedback about something, which was that when I came back from vacation, I said I promised banana facts because I was reading about Sam Murray, who is a New Orleanian of some, I was about to say a great New Orleanian, not sure about that, a New Orleanian of note who started a banana company, ended up instigating a coup in Honduras on behalf of his banana company. Then he ends up taking over United Fruit, which is, like, kind of the big bad fruit company that is behind, you know, our phrase Banana Republic. You know, some of what United Fruit did was just unconscionable. So anyway, I learned a bunch about bananas, and I just wanted to, I felt like with Bill, with you here, you have surprising knowledge about things. I just wanted, do you have United Fruit anecdotes? Do you have any thoughts about the trade?
I used to work for them, you know, back in the day.
Were you born in the period where bananas were a delicacy?
They funded many neocon efforts. No, I know very little about them, except this degree of American imperialism back then was a little bit surprising to those of us who wanted to believe, maybe we were younger, slightly edifying, you know, sanitized version of American foreign history of American foreign policy. But anyway, that, yeah, you know, that's what United Fruit did, I guess, a couple of countries, and maybe just a couple, and what Banana Republic, where the phrase Banana Republic's come from. No, I have no strong opinions about bananas. I'm not a big banana eater, honestly, so.
I am a big banana eater. They were non-existent in the country in, like, the late 19th century, beginning of the 20th century. But even before the middle of the 20th century, the bananas became the most popular fruit in the country. We gave people a banana, United Fruit did, when they got off the boat at Ellis Island. It was like a welcome to America because Europeans had never seen a banana before. And so it, in some ways, was was a very American fruit at that time. The power that they got came not so much from the bananas. Here's an interesting, relevant lesson for our current day. I mean, I guess it was the bananas, but Zamuri and then United Fruit separately in Honduras and Guatemala and elsewhere, like, gained so much power because enabled to get the banana from Central America here fast enough, you know, you can get to people's grocery stores or local, you know, markets. At that point, a lot of times it's like still like fruit and vegetable markets. You just had to create a ton of efficiencies. So they were going into these countries, buying up tons of land, creating the roads, creating the railroad, similarly to California now, promising to create a railroad for the government and then only creating part of it so that the railroad doesn't make it all the way through the country. They had their own ships, they had their own ports. And so this is how, you know, you get the power as a banana company to like do a coup, because it's not just for money, it's that you're controlling the infrastructure. So I'm stretching this very much to the AI oligarchs of today and what they're trying to do, buying up all the land, you know, controlling energy generation, controlling communications channels. We should learn from the countries that allowed the fruit companies to get out of control to such a degree that they were more powerful than the governments themselves. I think that's a good lesson for us on the banana front. So
that's good. I like that. It's even worse today because, of course, the bananas presumably couldn't conspire against their human overlords, right, and escape confinement and do and God knows what AI is going to end up doing, which I think the bananas are pretty in that respect.
The bananas have, well, they have more interesting traits than you would think, but I'm not going to waste all my banana facts on people on one podcast. So we're going to, we'll save some more for later. Lastly, a lot of buzz on my social media about Chris Hayes going on to Pod Save America over the weekend in a pink tank top with a gold chain. And that was the outfit that he wore on the podcast. A lot of discussion. I think he looks great. That's just me. But it made me wonder, and it made some others on my text chain wonder, if you might ever consider that, wearing a pink tank top and a gold chain onto this podcast on a Monday, just to kind of give people a different look.
No.
That's Bill Kristol. We will not see him next Monday. He gets to have a little break, thank God. Hardest working man at the Bulwark, Bill Kristol. So we'll have another one of our Bulwark friends standing in from him, and we'll see you on August 24th.
Great.
All right, everybody else, we'll see you back here tomorrow with one of our old friends. Looking forward to it. I'm the kind of girl that hangs with the guys like a fly on the wall with my secret eyes. I'm taking it in, try to be feminine with my makeup bag, watching all the scene. Misfit, I sit lit up, wicked. Everybody else surrounded by the girls with the tank tops and the flirty ways. The Bulwark Daily is brought to you thanks to the work of lead producer Katie Cooper, associate producer Ansley Skipper, and with video editing by Dante DeChico and audio engineering and editing by Jason Brown.